This is a podcast from the BBC. For more information and terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
37, take 4.
We had some Germans fetched in an ambulance once, and they were talking to us in broken English, and one of them said, oh, he said, Belgian, no good shot. French, no good shot. British, he too damn good shot. Now, what these Germans thought, when our boys had opened up, our infantry had opened up, that they were opposing nests of machine guns. But they weren't. All they were opposing was their rifles. And all these boys were firing at 15 rounds a minute, which misled the Germans to think that they'd got big batteries of machine guns. And I believe the compliment of a battalion was two machine guns only.
And yes, that's fine. That's the summary.
For the Great War series, broadcast in 1964, the BBC collected interviews with over 250 people, including civilians, nurses, and those serving at the front, from infantrymen and junior officers to generals, all witnesses to the war, on the home front, in the trenches, and from the air. Though recorded almost 50 years after the start of the conflict, they've become an invaluable record of the human experience of the war.
800 yards, almost...
Would you like to start again?
Yes, I'd better, I think. Okay. September 1915, when we made our big attack on Loos. To our right was Loos itself, and to our left was Hulluch, which was our objective. And straight in front of us...
Among the recordings made for this landmark series, one in particular stands out. John Palmer was a British gunner who served as a signaller with the Royal Field Artillery between 1914 and 1917. In his interview in 1963, he admitted to scavenging food to supplement his bully beef rations, pinching rabbits and chickens where he could. He spoke of witnessing thousands of refugees leaving Belgium at the outbreak of the war, and he spoke of the men's feet bleeding during the retreat from Mons, a march of more than 150 miles across the fields of Belgium and France. He also talked about the advancements in weaponry he saw during the war.
And the gas was let loose. We had gas cylinders already prepared there. It was the first time. They went up with these Ku Klux Klan sort of masks on. They just fitted straight over the head with a little mouthpiece. And, of course, the exertion of going almost 800 yards uphill, loaded with ammunition...
And then the questions turn to the Passchendaele of a century ago.
Well, it was mud everywhere. Mud in the trenches, mud in front of the trenches, behind the trenches. Every shell hole was a sea of filthy, oozing mud. I was tired of seeing infantry sinking back in that morass, never to come out alive again. I was tired of all the carnage, of all the sacrifice that we had there, just to gain about 25 yards. And this night, I think I'd reached my lowest ebb.
A lot of soldiers admitted to wanting blighty wounds, an injury that wasn't life-threatening, but was enough to get you home for a while, for a rest. Some gave themselves self-inflicted wounds, even though that was an offence. Historian Peter Hart carried out many of the interviews in the Imperial War Museum's collection and also knows the BBC's Great War interviews inside out.
He's symbolic of all those men who perhaps we haven't recorded or weren't as eloquent as he was, because I think he puts it beautifully. For me, he stands for all those soldiers who suffered so much and who just came to the end of their tether, who just couldn't cope anymore. It's not cowardice, it's just... exhaustion. He'd fought all through the war. He'd been through the Battle of Loos and been badly wounded there. He'd seen men gassed to death. And then he'd fought all the way through the Somme, the mud and blood of the Somme. And then here he was again. And he just couldn't cope anymore. It's just grinding fatigue. And also post-traumatic stress. He was suffering from all the experiences he'd had in the war so far. And it all came in a perfect storm that night at Passchendaele, 3rd Ypres.
I'd been out on the wires all day, all night. I hadn't had any sleep, it seemed, for weeks, and no rest. And it was very, very difficult to mend a telephone wire in this mud. You'd find one end, and then you'd try and trudge through the mud to find the other end. And as you got one foot out, the other one would go down. The Germans were sending over quite a barrage, and I crouched down in one of these dirty shell holes. And then I began to think of those poor devils who had been punished for self-inflicted wounds. Some had even been shot, and I began to wonder how I could get out of it. And I sat there and kept thinking, and it's very lonely when you're on your own. And then in the distance, I heard the rattle of harness. I didn't hear much of the wheels, but I knew there were ammunition wagons coming up. And I thought to myself, well, here's a way out. When they get level with me, I'll ease out and put my leg under the wheel. I should be bound to get away, and I can plead it was an accident. Well, I waited, and the sound of the harness got nearer and nearer. Eventually, I saw the leading horses' heads in front of me, and I thought, this is it. And I began to ease my way out, and eventually the first wagon reached me. And you know, I never even had the guts to do that. I found myself wishing to do it, but hadn't got the guts to do it.
He was a signaller, and it was his job to mend the telephone wires between the forward observation posts and the gun battery. Now, in the shelling that was going on, they were continually being blown up and cut, and he'd have to go out in the mud, the awful mud of Ypres, and he'd have to mend the wires. Imagine you've got a telephone line that's been cut by artillery, and you've got one bit there, but you can't find the other bit, and you're scrabbling round in the mud with corpses and everything else, all the other awful things, trying to find the other wire. And then when you've got it, the two ends, you've got to tie them up and make sure and test them. And then 10 minutes later, it goes again, and you have to go out and do the whole thing again. And that's why he's so tired, he's so stressed, he just can't do it anymore.
Peter Hart. Miles and miles of mud. Churned up marshland, stagnant water, twisted, shattered weapons, pieces of men. That was the Ypres battlefield after 3 years of shelling by 1917. You can understand those who just wanted to get out of it. Almost 50 years after his experiences at Passchendaele, in an incredibly honest interview, John Palmer recalled the depths of his despair towards the end of his time in Flanders Fields.
Well, I went on, I finished my wire, I found the other end and mended it. I was out twice more that night. I was out next day. And the next night, my pal came out with me. He wasn't busy on the other wires. And after the Germans had stopped shelling a little while, we heard one of their big ones coming over. And normally, within reason, you could tell if one was going to land anywhere near or not. If it was, the normal procedure was to throw yourself down and avoid the shell fragments. This one, we knew, was going to drop near. My pal shouted and threw himself down. I was too damn tired even to fall down. I stood there. Next, I had a terrific pain in the back and the chest, and I found myself face downwards in the mud. My pal came to me. He tried to lift me up, and I said to him, "Don't touch me. Leave me. I've had enough. Just leave me." The next thing, I found myself sinking down in the mud, and this time, I didn't worry about the mud. I didn't hate it anymore. It seemed like a protective blanket covering me. And I thought to myself, well, if this is death, it's not so bad.
Few armies in history have faced conditions as appalling as those that confronted John Palmer and his comrades. It was this apocalyptic landscape that Palmer was having to crawl around in night after night. He's the voice of the British soldier of 1917, exhausted, drained, almost broken.
And then I found myself being bumped about, and I realised that I was on a stretcher, and I thought, poor devils, these stretcher bearers. I wouldn't be a stretcher bearer for anything. And then something else happened. I suddenly realised that I wasn't dead. I realised that I was alive. I realised that if these wounds didn't prove fatal, that I should get back to my parents, to my sister, to the girl that I was going to marry. The girl that had sent me a letter every day, practically, from the beginning of the war. Then, the dressing station, morphia, and I must then have had that sleep that I so badly needed, for I didn't recollect any more until I found myself in a bed with white sheets, and I heard the lovely, wonderful voices of our nurses, English, Scotch, and Irish. And I think then I completely broke down.
Over 500,000 men on all sides were killed, wounded or captured between the 31st of July and the 10th of November 1917. And that doesn't include the unknowable numbers of men who survived but who carried the terrible mental wounds for the rest of their lives. Oddly, the more I learn about Passchendaele, the harder I find it to grasp just what it was like for John Palmer and his mates on that battlefield. Even the endless lists of dead don't seem to drive home the true horror. That's why I wanted to focus this episode on just one person's experience. John Palmer's words from Beyond the Grave are Passchendaele's most powerful epitaph.
Next, the padre was sitting beside the bedside. He was trying to comfort me. He told me I'd had an operation. And he told me that he had some relatives out there that had been out there right from the beginning. And by God's grace, they hadn't had a scratch. He said, they've been lucky, haven't they? I thought to myself, lucky. Poor devils.